I didn't need another reason to never leave the house, I can now add hordes of murderous birds to the list, which is why it's so great that Sparkplug Coffee delivers. What's Sparkplug Coffee, you ask? Well, Sparkplug is a coffee delivery service that you need in your life right now. Sparkplug starts with premium Arabica beans that use only coffee that's been directly sourced and fairly traded. But what makes Sparkplug really special is that they custom roast the coffee themselves here in Toronto and deliver it to your home or office within 1 week so that it always reaches you fresh and at its peak flavor, which is more than you can say for any coffee you get at the grocery store or your local cafe. You can order as you need it, or take advantage of Sparkplug's autopilot, set it and forget it delivery so that you never run out of fresh roasted coffee. And right now, Sparkplug has a special offer for Top 100 listeners. If you use the promo code TOP100PROJECT at checkout, that's all one word, and the number 100, Sparkplug will give you 10% off your next coffee order. And you don't need to be a new customer to take advantage. The time has never been better to change your mornings from the safety of your own home. Plug yourself in at sparkplugcoffee.com.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Project.
And action.
Hi, everybody, and thank you from Toronto to Bodega Bay for taking part in the next 123 project, the Monday morning jibber-jabber that doles out our thoughts about classic movies. We used to be the people who reviewed the AFI's 1998 and 2007 lists of great American motion pictures, but we're nearly 3 years past being done with that. In fact, with this podcast, we have now done as many Next 100 Project movies as we did Top 100 Project movies. And we didn't even know if we'd do 10 podcasts when we started, never mind 270-ish. So congratulations to us.
Yay!
So anyway, we spoil movies, and be careful of that if you don't like spoilage. I'm the guy with his eyes pecked out of his head so gruesomely, Ryan Ellis, and here's the blonde who wears the same clothes day after day and doesn't seem to mind, my wife Bev.
That's me.
When Melanie goes to the local store or whatever it is and buys just a nightgown, doesn't have any underwear in there. So either she's washing it every day, or she's wearing it every day, or maybe because she's so risque, doesn't even wear underwear.
Wow. I did not think about it, but you did.
Could have been washing her clothes, that's one thing. And wearing the same clothes every day isn't so bad. But just like Cary Grant in North by Northwest, she wears the same outfit for almost the entire movie. He has a few different outfits in that movie, but mostly wears the blue suit. And here she's wearing the green dress, pantsuit, whatever it is.
Yeah.
Not dress, pantsuit.
Yeah, dress suit. In both cases, they keep thinking that they're about to go home. She doesn't think she's going to spend the night every time until she chooses to spend the night.
Okay, the coming attractions trivia for this week's picture, The Birds, another Hitchcock film. F. Hitchcock. We've done 7 of his movies now, I think it is. Notorious, Shadow of a Doubt, this, and then 4 AFI movies. So yeah, 7. Considering how many thrillers Hitch directed, it's no surprise that he had a lot of black hats nominated for the Top 100 Heroes and Villains list. 2 made it, so name them, and also name the 8. I said last week 9, although I corrected this on the website, but I think it's only 8 nominees who didn't make the villainous cut. And also his one nominated hero, who wasn't actually a hero in that movie, according to us.
I'm glad you corrected it, because I only found 8 as well, but the 2 that did make the list were Mrs. Danvers from Rebecca. She was number 31 on the villains list, and number 2 on the villains list was Norman Bates, Psycho. Pretty predictable. And the other 8 were, in no particular order, Bruno Anthony on Strangers on a Train, The Birds in The Birds, Lars Thorwald in Rear Window, Philip Morgan and Brandon Shaw in Rope, Uncle Charlie Oakley in Shadow of a Doubt, he should have made it, Alexander Sebastian in Notorious, Philip Van Damme, North by Northwest, and Tony Wendis, Dial M for Murder, and the hero was Jeff Jeffries in Rear Window. But was he a hero?
Not really. But you got them all. A couple of Phillips in there, by the way. Philip Van Damme in North by Northwest, and Philip in Rope.
There must have been a Philip in Hitch's life that he was not fond of. Kind of like how the bad alien in Galaxy Quest is called.
Saris.
Saris, like the
film critic.
Critic
Andrew Saris.
Yeah.
Who gave a bad review to a previous movie by the director, Dean Pariseau. Yeah, so Hitch had a lot of villains. I didn't look to see if he had the most of any director, but if it's not the most there, then that's got to be close to the most.
As I was going through the list, Stanley Kubrick had a lot. He would have heroes and villains on the list.
Nicholson
I was just
from The Shining.
Mm-hmm.
HAL 9000 in 2001. And
Alex DeLarge.
That's 3 right there. And he only made 13 movies.
Yeah.
Okay, The Birds was released by Universal on March 29th, 1963. So that makes it a 55-year-old movie. And it made big bank. It was nominated for the 1998 and 2007 AFI Top 100 lists. Although I guess the voters thought 4 Hitchcocks on those lists was enough. And they were right, because The Birds isn't good enough to have made those lists. Maybe Notorious and even Shadow of a Doubt were worthy. Notorious, probably more so. Anyway, Bev, give the skinny of the birds.
Tippi Hedren is Melanie, a rich gadabout with a bad reputation and a penchant for practical jokes and prosecutors who are rude to her. Prosecutors like Mama's boy Mitchell Brenner, played by Rod Taylor, who inadvertently lures Melanie to his hometown of Bodega Bay just in time for the mysterious and deadly phenomenon of birds violently turning on the townspeople. Together with Mitchell's family, they face this bizarre problem with no cause and no apparent solution.
Bodega Bay is not too far from San Francisco, by the way, for those who may not know that. Or, in a nutshell, Troublemaker performs B&E on Stranger's House. Avian revenge ensues. Or, Angry Birds, the movie. And I guess Hitch is the pig.
Oh.
A low blow, but we're going to learn in this podcast, if you didn't already hear that story, or many stories, that he was a bit of a pig. A lot of a pig, really. All right, so the Rotten Tomatoes numbers. 96% of critics liked the movie. 50 fresh, only 2 rotten. And 83% of audiences. They even showed it at Cannes about a month after the wide release of the picture. Taxi Driver did the same thing. It came out in the early part of the year and then was at Cannes in May. All right, well, I just said I don't love the movie. I think it's a thumb up, but a bit of a marginal one. Partly because it takes forever to get anywhere. Although the action scenes do deliver. So I'm mixed on this. What about you?
I think the movie's mostly just okay. With a handful of scenes that are so good that it kind of makes up for its faults. I hate the first act. It's full of muddy motivations and a lot of setup that never pays off. The concept still stands out as strange and gutsy, which helps buoy it. And of course, the suspense is just outstanding. It's a bad film that kind of eventually becomes a good film in its final act.
Yeah, it's one of those movies that's best at the very end. The last 30 minutes especially.
Yeah.
Kind of like Aliens when it finally gets going. It really gets going. Not that Aliens is slow-paced, exactly. What did you think of the lead performance? Because I don't think either of us were big fans of Tippi Hedren.
She's not terrible, but she doesn't bring...
She's not talented, though.
It's a gift, and I'm sure it's hard to pull off, and I think the best actors make it look easy, but it is a gift to really pull off fear. I don't think you can have a good horror film unless you have an actor who can sell terror.
And she sold it because Hitch was actually terrorizing her.
But there's so many scenes where she seems bemusedly interested in what's going on around her without any real investment. She has a good cool to her, and I think she's better in the first act of the film, where she's this kind of mysterious girl who behaves in many ways like a man. And she's really brash and bold and spoiled and vain. And I kind of like her icy demeanor then, but if you can't sell the fear... It's kind of a failure of a performance.
And she's not quite cool enough or weird enough in the opening half of the movie either, I don't think. She looks pretty good, and that's why Hitch cast her, because he wanted to fuck her, because he saw her in a commercial, and she was a hot blonde. I might be able to take her down to my bedroom and fuck her, or even just pretend I can.
She is smoking hot. She's a total babe.
I wouldn't say smoking hot, but okay.
As you say that, I'm going to take back what I said, because... Her motivations in the first half of the film make no sense whatsoever. I don't even put together until we're well into the second act that, oh no, she actually really does like Mitch. I couldn't tell if she wanted revenge or if she was just a bored rich girl.
She wanted to bang him, I think.
Yeah, and then it becomes clear she's in love with him. Her character seems to do a total 180 halfway through the film. The first half of the film makes no sense with the rest of it, and one of the major failures is there's no chemistry between her and Mitchell.
Yeah, Rod Taylor may not be the greatest actor of all time either. He's in Inglourious Basterds, which we'll cover next year. He's got the role as Churchill, a very brief role. He's okay in this movie, but he's not one of Hitchcock's great leading men. Cary Grant, Sean Connery were talked about. Connery was in the next movie by Hitch with also Hedren, Marnie, which is a very controversial film as well. And even Farley Granger from Strangers on a Train was talked about for this role. But they went with Taylor. They got the big, meaty kind of looking dude and supposed to be a lawyer. Seems like more of a lumberjack in a way than a lawyer. So maybe part of the problem rests at his feet, too. But you talked about the first half makes no sense. Mitch's mother, Jessica Tandy, long before Driving Miss Daisy and Cocoon and all those films, is wary of her from the beginning. She seems to be onto the fact that Melanie's no good, or at least bad news. Maybe not no good, that's a little strong. But she's not the kind of girl that Lydia would want for her son. And then she just about faces on that.
But we also learned that it's not necessarily Melanie's fault, because that's exactly how she behaved towards Annie, Mitch's other suitor.
Suzanne Plachette.
Yes, who's also gorgeous and loved Mitch so much that she uprooted her life and moved to Bodega Bay.
4 years earlier.
Even though she knew it was probably hopeless because his mother would get between them. So it's not so much that she has a problem with Melanie, it's that she has a problem with any woman that she's afraid is going to take Mitch away from her.
Psycho-esque.
But I don't know if it's that she's jealous. I think it's more she fears abandonment. I think that's what's implied, that she's so scared of being alone.
So if he has a wife or even just a girlfriend, he can't spend all that time up there. He can't go there every weekend.
Yeah, Lydia. Sounds like
he goes, I love the neighbor, too, back in San Francisco. Knows everything about Mitch's life. Mr. Exposition.
He spends just about every weekend in Bodega Bay.
He's Basil Exposition back home, and he's Basil Exposition in Bodega Bay.
And Lydia's also mourning her dead husband, Mitch's father. So maybe he's kind of a replacement for his dead father a little bit.
And his much younger sister. It's a very perverse family. Veronica Cartwright, who's been in three classic thrillers or horror films, whatever you want to call them. The Birds, Alien, and the year before that, the 1978 Invasion of the Body Snatchers. And she's done a lot of other things, but I always think of those three big ones for her when she was a little girl and then as a grown woman, but a bit of an oddball on those two pictures. She's young enough to be Mitch's daughter, but she is his sister. And there's nothing wrong with that, but it just makes for a weird family dynamic.
Yeah, but I think it's because you need a child to be protected. They needed a kid in there, and there was no other way to put her in there. I mean, look at Jessica Tandy. She actually looks really great for her age in this film, but she doesn't look young enough to have a 12, 13-year-old daughter. Is it her 14th birthday that they're getting the birds for?
Something 12? Like that.
I can't remember, but I guess you could just argue that they had two children very far apart. It's not that uncommon. But I think really it's just that Hitchcock wanted a kid in the film to be in peril.
Especially in the very famous attack on the school. That is probably the best scene in the whole film. If it's not the best scene, then the one at the end, or the ones at the end, the big build-up in the attic, and then the very end of the film. But that attack on the schoolhouse is classic.
Well, the build-up to that attack is
one of the best things.
It is the best thing in the film, actually. Yeah, yeah.
No music. Bernard Herrmann, Hitchcock's regular composer, did all those great scores. Never once nominated for Hitchcock's score, though, which is hard to believe. He was involved in this movie, though, just not as a composer. There wasn't actually a composer, but he was involved with the sound design. And when you watch the opening sequence, which I did again just a few minutes ago, because I wanted to see something. We mentioned this, I think, last week. Yeah, we did on It Follows. There is a print of this for free on YouTube. So if you haven't already watched it, but you want to see this movie, go find it. It should still be there. It seems like it's been on for a long time. It Follows, I thought maybe it would get pulled down. It's one of those things I saw it. Oh, man, I'll tell everybody, and then it won't be there 5 days later. But it's been there for over a year, and The Bird seems to have been a long time as well. So anyway, when I just played the opening bit, the sound effects of the birds just being birds sounds odd and weird. And I'm sure Herrmann had a big part of that, just like Psycho and all the other scores he did for Hitchcock, taking these great classical instruments that he uses and making them scary. Violins and Psycho, classic example.
I hate the noise that they use for the birds.
Too much for you then, okay.
It just doesn't sound like birds. Why not just record birds? We have the sound of birds. We have the technology to record birds bird noises.
And in that great sequence where they're massing outside the school, there's barely any noise. You hear a little bit of fluttering, but you don't hear the sound of them cawing and making all those noises that birds make. You keep cutting back, and that was the idea. You show Melanie sitting there. She's smoking a cigarette, whatever. She's waiting for Kathy to come out. And then you cut to the jungle gym with 5 birds on it. Go to Melanie, cut back 10 birds. Cut to Melanie, go back, and there's 20 birds. And then suddenly she realizes, oh my God.
There's like 1,000.
The visual effects were nominated for an Oscar. Ub Iwerks, I think is how you say his name, the guy who was in charge of the sodium vapor process is what it's called. They don't look as good now as they undoubtedly did back in 63 because a lot of it's, what do you call that, mats? I think it's called mats, isn't it, anyway?
Yeah, I think so. And for this old-fashioned from like the 60s and 70s, yeah.
And the gas station explosion sequence when it goes wide and the birds, as you pointed, bird's eye view, and then suddenly the birds come into that view. That's an impressive sequence for 1963, but it doesn't look so good now because you can tell. I've also seen the making of in this movie once or twice. But you can tell where they've laid in the part with the fire, and then they've got just a painting of the town, and then the birds themselves. So a lot of different elements. The very last sequence has, I don't remember, but it might be a dozen different pieces of film to put all those birds in there. Because, of course, the birds wouldn't all cooperate with each other if you tried to put them in one scene together.
The visual effects, I think, for the time are pretty outstanding. They're good enough that I'm not thinking about it. I'm not really noticing it. There's nothing corny about it that takes me away. Not the way the audio does. I think the sound design is atrocious. They had to use that, what do you call it, the sodium vapor technique?
Sodium vapor process.
Process. It was because, and I can tell you this because I'll use green screen in my work plenty, when you have something that's fast moving, like a bird's wing, you get blur in the film frame. That blur in a green screen would be like half green and half white, whatever the color of the bird is. And that gives you always a messy matte. And this is how they got around it, was with this process.
There's no explanation for why the birds attack. That's one of the best things about the movie, too. There's no real end to any of this, too. The movie has that very unusual, although in this month of movies we've picked, just coincidentally, that have four female leads and four endings where it's not really over, and it follows. We talked about that last week, how we believe those kids might still be followed. But I think that movie is implying, much like Halloween did, that it isn't really over.
Yeah.
This one clearly goes for that. The Witch, well, we'll talk about that next week.
Yeah, we won't spoil The Witch. You should see it.
And Rosemary's Baby is pretty infamous. We'll talk about that in a couple of weeks. But this is one of the better old school examples of a movie that just stops, as Robert Altman would say. Movies don't end. They stop because stories just stop, because you can keep on going with somebody's life forever and ever until they die. As these people drive away, the birds have taken over everywhere and apparently are going to be a problem in San Francisco and nearby towns. Clearly, this is an epidemic and we're only seeing a little part of this. Now, did Melanie start the bird attack? A lot of people have these theories, and maybe that theory is sound because it only really seems to start in Bodega Bay when she gets there. And also, birds attack in two different times when Kathy is either mentioned or she is just the issue at hand. They attack on the boat when she is taking the lovebirds to the Brenner house and when she's going back, and at Annie's house when Kathy is mentioned. Now, it's not Kathy that's the problem. I'm not saying that at all. But those are two specific examples of when birds do attack, when the kid is the issue.
So I have a whole elaborate theory. It's not Melanie that's the cause of the birds. The birds are the manifestation of Lydia's fear of abandonment. The first bird attack comes when Melanie and Mitch are about to meet at the dock, not for the first time, but after she's dropped off the lovebirds. There's quite a bit of build up to that moment. He's chasing in the car, she's in the boat, and you're kind of anticipating this great romantic tete-a-tete that's going to happen there, and there's going to be this cute little romance thing happening there, but instead she gets attacked by the bird and it gets thwarted, which actually probably works in her favor because then he has to look after her.
It's like that scene in Seinfeld. That bird ran right into your head. It's like it couldn't avoid it. That's good for comedy in that case, though.
And then the second bird attack comes, although attack, whatever, when the bird hits the door in Annie's house.
Because they're talking about Kathy.
Because they're talking, no, but it's the moment that Annie convinces Melanie to just go to that birthday party, even though she has doubts. See, Annie's just told her, you'll never get past the mom. She's going to thwart any attempts to get to Mitchell. And then she goes, you know what, though? Go to the party. And the second later, that bird hits the door. The third attack comes, and this is probably the best example, when they're at the birthday party, and Melanie and Mitch are off on their own having a little romantic walk. Lydia comes out of the house, sees them, makes a funny face, like, what's going on over there? Immediately, seagulls attack the party and ruin it.
As only seagulls can, those little scavenger bastards.
Listen, seagulls, it doesn't take much for seagulls to ruin a party. Then the next attack comes when they're all in the house, kind of talking about what happened. Mitch and Kathy are trying to convince Melanie to spend the night, even though Lydia's like, oh, if you take the freeway, you can get home in an hour. As they're trying to convince her to stay, and you can see that Melanie's giving in, then suddenly birds flood in through the chimney. Now, from here, it gets a little harder to pin down.
The schoolhouse one, for example, has nothing to do with Lydia.
Nor does the one in the diner. There's all kinds of stuff from there on. But you could argue that also at that point, Lydia starts to come around to Melanie. Kathy loves Melanie.
Always.
And Melanie, once she's in the house with the family, is very much on her best behavior. And there's a lot of connections that we're supposed to draw between Melanie and Lydia because Hitchcock very intentionally dresses them alike. They have the same hairstyle. At the birthday party, they're virtually wearing the same outfit, except that Lydia's is gray and Melanie's is green, but it's almost identical. And even the casting, they look alike. Jessica Tandy looks like she could be Tippi Hedren's mother.
And Tippi Hedren, by the way, a little bit of a piece of information here, is Melanie Griffith's mother.
And by extension, Dakota Johnson's grandmother.
And Antonio Banderas is in the family because he was married to Melanie Griffith for a long time. I don't think he is anymore, but he was.
I can't remember, did they have children?
No one famous that I'm aware of.
Well, you can still have children whether they become famous or not.
In Hollywood, can you?
I don't know. Melanie Griffith, a better actress than her mother.
Oh, absolutely. She is a very good actress. She's been great in a lot of things, like the Working Girl time frame back then when she was doing everything. Something Wild was around the same time. Back to what you're saying.
Oh, yeah. I can totally wrap this up, I promise. We talk about how the film has no ending, and here's where I make the argument that perhaps, at the very least, the second half of the film is less about Melanie's arc and more about Lydia's arc, because if she's the one who's kind of summoning the birds with her emotions, let's say. How does the film end? Thousands of birds, but they're calm. Melanie is catatonic, and she's turning to Lydia to mother her and to comfort her. They're in the car. She's leaning on her shoulder. She's kind of looking up at her wide-eyed. She's hurt. She's bleeding, and Lydia's taking care of her.
Lydia won.
For Lydia to win is to simply not be lonely, not be abandoned. And there's a line when Anne and Melanie are in the house together. Melanie, who was abandoned by her own mother, says, why should Lydia be afraid? If Mitch got married, she would be gaining a daughter. And I think at the end, what's happened is Lydia has gained a daughter, and that's why the birds are calm.
But then they seem to be taking over the Southern California.
Then you turn on the radio and it ruins my theory. And Hitchcock himself was like, I don't know why the birds attack.
It is based on a book by Daphne du Maurier, her 1952 novelette. And she wrote the Rebecca novel as well. Of course, Hitchcock's first big American movie was Rebecca. So he's basing this on someone else's work in the first place. This isn't an original idea.
They made their share of changes, though. I think that the whole romance at the beginning was an invention of the film.
Maybe this way doesn't work as well.
It really
does. The writer of the movie was Evan Hunter, who wrote detective stories in which he was Ed McBain. That was his best-known thing. And yeah, that's some of the weaker parts of the movie, the screenplay and just the first half in general. Melanie, by the way, is not quite the gadabout, according to her, that she's accused of being. There's talk of her jumping into a fountain naked, which might be and probably is an homage to La Dolce Vita, which is only a year or two before this movie came out. And her dad runs a newspaper, but then she tells Mitch a lot of those stories are exaggerated or even flat-out lies. She claims that she's not this flighty woman that just runs into fountains.
I mean, she's a flighty woman who buys lovebirds, speeds to Bodega Bay, rents a boat.
Rather than just drive the car,
breaks into her crush's house and leaves the birds in his house. That's crazy. Mm. I was thinking about this. In all the Hitchcock films that we've seen, many of them have a romance of some kind. And in almost every single case, one person involved in that romance should be arrested for something that they do to the other person.
Or it's at least a bad match, like a Rear Window, where there's nothing really wrong with either one of them, but Jimmy Stewart doesn't want Grace Kelly.
In Notorious,
Cary Grant.
Yeah, Cary Grant punches her in the face and knocks her unconscious and also sets her up to shut her up.
She could be killed by the Nazis.
Yeah. In this film, Tippi Hedren and Melanie acts like a complete basket case. Call the police, bro. Get her out of there. She's nuts.
And he is a lawyer, so he actually knows about these things.
North by Northwest, Eve Marie Saint is totally setting him up, right?
Suspicion, Cary Grant. The whole movie's about, is he trying to kill his wife, Joan Fontaine?
Vertigo is next level crazy. The stuff they do to each other, they should be put in prison for.
All right, so then we're leading into probably the biggest thing about this movie, behind the scenes at least. You're talking about Hitchcock having unhealthy relationships in his movies. Well, maybe he always felt this way and you don't really hear stories about him doing this to Ingrid Bergman. I never have, so maybe he never did, or maybe he knew better with her, I don't know. But by this point, with Tippi Hedren, he cast her from a commercial, and then he wants to mold her and be her mentor and all that kind of stuff. But he also clearly, from what you hear at least, wanted to fuck her. And she rebuffed him. So then after Marnie, which is a complicated movie, by the way, I'm not a big fan of that one, where she's a cold fish, after that he supposedly ruined her career. Because she had a contract with him, and then I guess he didn't use her. I think there's something like a 4-year gap after Marnie where she didn't make a movie.
He had a 7-year contract, and he refused to cast her, and he refused to let her do anything outside of the contract.
So he ruined her career after he gave her a career. And I know it sounds a little mean to say this, but we wouldn't know her name if it weren't for the fact that he wanted to fuck her in the first place. He obviously shouldn't have treated her the way he did. The girl with Sienna Miller. Yeah, Sienna Miller played Tippi Hedren. I forget who played Hitchcock.
I think it was Toby Jones.
Oh, that sounds right, yeah. Because Hopkins played him in the big screen movie that was just called Hitchcock. And both those movies dealt with the fact that, at least by then, Alfred Hitchcock was being way more blunt about what he really wanted from these women. This guy would obviously fail the Me Too test.
Oh, yeah, and then some. I saw that film. You saw The Girl, didn't you?
Yeah, it was pretty good.
I found it quite memorable because I really didn't know that much about him. I mean, I knew he had a reputation of being a bit of a prick, that he could just be mean to his actors and to men, too. There's the notorious story, I can't remember the movie, where he wants a child to act scared. And so he genuinely scared him. He said something about how if he didn't nail this scene, he was going to kill his parents, and the kid virtually peed his pants or something.
Wow.
I can't remember. I'm probably getting the details all wrong, but just the point of the story is that in order to get the scene, to get the shot, to get the performance, he was very mean to a child. So he's just one of those people who is a monster to get his way.
Well, being mean to a kid, by the way, maybe in our eyes, that's a bit of a hero.
Shh, don't
Heroes and villains list, here he comes.
We don't want our listeners to know. Or dog people. If he was mean to a dog, I would be like, that's over. We're never covering another Hitchcock.
He is cameo as walking dogs in this movie.
That's true.
He's walking two dogs and we have two dogs.
And this movie's kind of on animal side in general, so there you go. At the same time, he has this great partnership with his wife, who he's open about the fact that she's his collaborator.
She should have been at least called a producer in every one of his movies. He didn't really even take producer credit, I don't think ever, but certainly not for most of his career. It was no producer credit of any kind. Alfred Hitchcock's name was always huge in the very last title card. Of course, the director's card, by the time he was a big star director, was the last title card. I've seen a lot of old movies lately on YouTube, hour and 10 minute noir films, that kind of thing. And Westerns sometimes, and the director credit is often buried. It might be the first thing you see after the actors, not the last credit. It's often the producer's credit.
Alfred Hitchcock was one of the first official auteurs. Cahiers du Cinéma singled him out.
Francois Truffaut was a huge fan and did interviews with him. Yeah, Hitchcock probably should have gotten writing credits on his movies as well, as should Alma. And when he won
Alma
his award
is his wife, by the way, Alma Hitchcock.
Yes, right, Alma Revel. I think it was the AFI Award, the Life Achievement Award. He didn't say much. Just like when he won his Thalberg, he went up and said thank you and walked off. Apparently, he didn't really say much of anything. But when he won his AFI Life Achievement, it was all about paying tribute to her, that she's the best cook and the best wife and the best mother and the best everything and the best film collaborator as well.
But she didn't get credit on most of his films. She got credit, was it Shadow of the Doubt when we covered that? In most of his films, she's just kind of in the background helping him out.
She was the power behind the throne, though. Not to say he wasn't talented, but Peter Bogdanovich, who worshipped Hitchcock and got to know him pretty well. Very interesting comparison between those two because Polly Platt was his wife when he did Last Picture Show and What's Up, Doc. I think she was still with him at that point, but definitely a Last Picture Show. But he became obsessed with Sybil Shepherd and eventually got together with her. I don't think he ever married her. After that, Bogdanovich didn't make movies that were nearly as good as the first one he made. Or was it the first? Or no, it wasn't his first. Targets was his first. But his best movie had his wife involved, and then when she wasn't involved, he wasn't the same guy anymore. So if Hitchcock had ever lost Alma, I wonder if the same thing would have happened to him.
Also, George Lucas never made another great film after Marshall Lucas left him. This is my own personal theory because I'm an editor, but Quentin Tarantino's work went pretty steeply downhill after Sally Menke's died.
Well, it's still good, but isn't what it was. It's
and
true.
That's not the same as having a wife behind the scenes who is helping you and not getting credit. I suspect that this happened a lot, that you have a collaborator, even just an ear, somebody whose taste you trust but doesn't get credit. And if you're a woman and you're super into film, chances are that would probably be the closest you could get to having influence. If you worked in the 50s, 60s, 70s, I mean, that would be the closest you could get to really influencing a film getting made.
Apparently Alma and Marshall Lucas were editing people as well. They weren't literally the editor of those movies. George Tomasini edited 9 Hitchcock movies, including Psycho. And his only nomination ever, by the way, was for North by Northwest. But it sounds like Alma, if she wasn't in the edit suite, was an editing partner. A director never gets credit for, and I shouldn't say never, but a director rarely gets credit for editing, and I'm sure they probably should almost every time. Like a Scorsese probably should be a co-director with Thomas Game Maker.
Edit their own films.
They literally do, that's true. There's no one else that does it other than them, apart from assistants. But what I'm saying is the women we're talking about, Menke, Lucas, and Revel, that without them in the edit suite or that kind of thing, in the editing process, pre and post, and probably during a production, these movies are nowhere near as good. And as we said, Lucas and Platt, leave their husbands and look at the difference.
It's an interesting thing, the editing profession in an industry that is as blatantly sexist as Hollywood is, and especially this time we're talking about in the 50s and 60s. If you look at all the other professions in film, there's virtually no women. Even now, there's very few women cinematographers. There's certainly very few women in lighting and all those kind of physical professions. But all the way through Hollywood history, while there's still way more men that do it, there's always these great editors who are women. Verna Fields and Dee Dee Allen. We've talked about them in so many of our podcasts. Back in the era of the silent film, when it really wasn't considered a craft, they likened it to sewing, so they would get girls to do it. It was like the typing pool. The editors were all women. The other place that I think women have managed to at least eke out some place in Hollywood is as screenwriters. You do see a fair number of screenwriters. And for whatever reason, when it comes to storytelling and editing, a big part of that is storytelling, women do seem to kind of rise to the top where they can't seem to in other professions. We're taking such a left turn, although it's kind of appropriate to spend a Hitchcock film talking about feminism because he was certainly...
He was not a feminist.
No, but he was a complicated figure because Alma was such a big part of his
films.
His
only kid was a daughter.
I'm certainly not apologizing for what he did. If he was working today, he would probably lose his career, as he should. You shouldn't get away with behaving the way he did. You know, if what Tippi Hedren is saying is true and she has no reason to lie, in my opinion, then Yes, of course.
He made a move on her.
She didn't get away with it.
He made a move on her in a limo is what I heard. They put that
but
in the
you
girl.
You say made a move, but in the movie he attempts to rape her. It is an assault.
Well, that's why I say, because he didn't actually go through with it. I know that's not cool either, but we can't accuse him of being a rapist because we don't know that. We don't even know for sure if the assault happened, but that TV movie portrays it, and stories have talked about it for a long time about how he did these things to at least her. And the funny thing is, you hear none of that from Janet Leigh. Apparently Suzanne Pleshette just rebuffed his bullshit. I don't know if he made moves on her, but she was just, Hitch, fuck off, basically. I don't know if she said that to him, but that was her implication.
Well, maybe part of the reason he wanted to discover an ingenue from nothing was that he knew he could get away with this kind of shit in a way that he never could with someone like Ingrid Bergman.
Suzanne Pleshette, by the way, we did Spirited Away last year. She's the voice of Yubaba in that movie. And then she's probably best known for Bob Newhart. But to put a bow on it with the Hitchcock stuff, because we don't have proof, it does sound like he would have massively failed the Me Too thing. Not cool, not cool the way he treated her. She's complained about that since, and I don't think that was really until the more recent era. I don't think you heard about that back in the 80s or maybe even the 90s. She probably just felt like she was empowered. He was long dead, and she was an older person by that point. Maybe she said, fuck it, I'm going to tell the truth about the way this guy treated me.
I saw an interview with her. She's surprisingly pretty cool about it, and she had lots of compliments to pay to his legacy as a filmmaker and his work. There's no doubt that he ruined my career because I wouldn't go to bed with him. But he's still a great filmmaker, and in his time and place, he got away with something.
It's a warped version of the Michael J. Fox quote that apparently Robert Zemeckis said on Back to the Future, pain is temporary, film is forever. She was injured in this movie more than once. The birds really attacked her at times, cutting her face up. They were attached to her clothes, especially in that scene in the attic. Now, the famous story from that is she said to him, why am I going up the attic again, Hitch? Because I'm telling you to.
Yeah.
Which is the thing we've said so many times in our podcast about, there'll be no movie unless you do this stuff. So she's right, but he's also got a point too, because how else does the movie end? I guess you could be more creative and have a different ending, but she goes up there so she can be traumatized. The birds are attacking her. It's a pretty memorable scene. And during the sequence when the birds attack the schoolhouse, she goes into a phone booth and a bird smashes in the window. And they show this in, I think it's Hitchcock, or maybe it's in The Girl, maybe it's in both of those, one TV movie, one actual movie. Glass hit her, and she was complaining about it, and he was basically saying, no, we're going to go ahead and shoot. It's almost like I'm going to terrorize her for real to get a real performance out of her.
Yeah, he punished her by putting her through hell on set.
Now, as for that schoolhouse, you hear children singing while Melanie's waiting for Kathy to get out. And it shouldn't be so eerie, but it is.
It really is.
And that leads into the birds massing on the jungle gym. The schoolhouse they used in Bodega Bay was supposedly haunted. And I don't know if that really matters to us, but it probably affected the performances of the actors to some degree. Not long after that, they end up in that pretty long scene in the diner. And Mrs. Bundy says there are billions of birds in the world. And this is 1963. Now, if that's true, how many more are there now? We've killed a lot of birds, especially chickens, but then we also breed things like chickens, so logically there are more birds now than there were then.
Well, there's probably more chickens than people. There's definitely got to be more chickens than people in the world, and there's 7.3 billion people, and so just chickens alone, we're talking billions.
So if they ever want to attack...
If they turned could, on us, it's
they could
over,
fuck
guys.
Us up, so like ants could. Mrs. Bundy talks about birds being beautiful. Ironically, then someone orders chicken at the diner. I'm going to eat that chicken... Birds are beautiful. They're also attacking.
Somebody comes in and is complaining about their chickens attacking. That's what prompts the visit to the farmhouse when they discover that the guy's actually been the first casualty of the birds.
Well, Lydia finds
eyes out.
That. That's such a gory moment. I'm surprised they got away with that back in the 60s. It's because it's a fast cut, I bet. You barely see anything.
Yeah, okay. But you see enough that certainly is burned
into
my mind.
You can't miss what happened, yeah.
Mrs. Bundy is an expert and nobody listens to her. She is repeatedly interrupted by all the men in the diner. You kind of have a pattern of people not listening to women. No one takes Lydia seriously when she's worried about things, even after she finds the corpse. She doesn't even expect Melanie to believe her, even though she witnessed all the other bird attacks. She's always apologizing for even caring about the catastrophe. And even Melanie's father won't believe her when she tries to tell him, you
phone.
Guys should be covering this. There's a huge news story happening. Birds are turning on people, and he is treating her like she's hysterical. Along with all the other stuff, this movie passes the Bechdel test with flying colors.
Surprisingly for Hitchcock.
Surprisingly for Hitchcock.
In this like era when he was blunt about what he wanted to do to his leading lady.
Quite refreshing. Mitch is the one character that is so bland. I guess he's handsome and he has a good kind of manly competence about him. But his appeal is a little bit lost, especially since people are so universally obsessed with him. All four of those women, Annie, Melanie, Lydia, and Kathy, are completely obsessed with him.
He's okay.
There's nothing nearly as interesting about him as there is about Melanie, Annie, and Lydia. But no one takes the women seriously until it's too late.
one of the big action highlights in the whole film is the Rube Goldberg fire that starts at the gas station. And Tippi Hedren talks about, in the making of, the face shots. So they cut to her and she's facing this way with this horrified look. And they cut back to the shot of the fire getting worse. And they cut to her facing it. And then cut back to the fire again and then back to her again. And she's in these still frames. I think they literally are still shots rather than her actually moving. And she talked about how that was an idea Hitchcock had. I don't think it works. Maybe partly because she can't act it very well. I don't know what it is. I like the idea, but I'm not a fan of how it worked out in the end. It didn't work.
Well, in many ways, it's his most experimental film that I've seen. So perhaps that went with the spirit of trying new and different things.
So why does Melanie go into the attic at the end? We don't have an actual answer. It took a week to shoot that sequence, and Hedren was actually traumatized. So if they were shooting at any point in sequence in that last bit, and often they don't, maybe the very last sequence was shot a month before, who knows, or a week after, or something like that. But because she was traumatized, maybe she didn't have to act all that much. She could just be, which is what actors always want to do in the first place. One thing that's pointed out in the making of, I never even noticed it until they actually talk about it, is when Mitch opens, quote-unquote, the front door. There's no door there. He just reaches, he pulls back, and the light comes on them as if he's opening the door. It's a great idea. You see them walking down the hall. You know what I'm talking about, do you?
No.
The end of the movie, when they're going to go to the car, at the very end, they're all walking down the hall, and you can see them coming towards the door. He reaches, well, I think it was his right hand, he pulls, and as he pulls nothing, but it's supposed to be the door, light comes on their faces as if it's from outside, and they walk ahead.
Oh my God, I did not notice that.
I didn't either until they point out in the making of.
That's amazing.
Not like it's any kind of effect. It's actually a very simple thing, but it's a Hitch idea, and it's a great one.
It's like a magician. If you just distract people's focus, you're looking at their face. You're not looking at his hand.
Mm-hmm.
You can really hide a lot of crazy stuff like that.
Zemeckis does stuff like that. There's a sequence I'm thinking of in Contact where Jodie Foster, I think it's the girl actually version, so the kid version of Jodie Foster, is running to the medicine cabinet. And you see her going towards the medicine cabinet, and then you realize that it's actually the shot from the other side too somehow. I forget. They explain that in the making of. That's a really interesting technical movie. You don't think of Contact as being that other than the space scenes or the interdimensional sequences. But there's a lot of shots that Zemeckis was good, kind of like Hitchcock, for showing us a sequence and realize, oh, what am I really looking at here in this cool way? So at the end when they come out and there's birds everywhere, is that a warning? You talked about it a little bit, maybe with Lydia. It's almost like, we'll let you go.
Yeah.
We'll be cool.
Yeah.
But fuck you, you're not coming back here. And if that's the case, why? But then they're also talking about birds massing everywhere. There's no the end at the end of this movie like most films had. And it's such an unusual touch. Also an unusual predator. Birds. And not even falcons or vicious ones or the ones that can be vicious. Bald eagles.
Even by today's standards, it's a bizarre conceit.
And apparently they were going to have a sequence at the very end where the Golden Gate Bridge is just lined with birds. But they didn't shoot that, maybe because it would have cost too much or they thought it was too much. And our characters are what we care about as they drive away and the birds are fluttering a little bit but not actually doing anything. Hitchcock would never have told anyone what he meant at the end either. Open to interpretation. So it's not the scariest movie we're going to watch this month and certainly not the scariest movie of all time. I think Psycho of his movies is definitely scarier, which was his previous movie, by the way, 3 years in between because he was shooting his TV show. But it's certainly one of the creepiest and weirdest, and partly because he uses birds as his bad guys. The movie's 185:1. We watched the DVD, which is not so beautiful, but there is that good print on YouTube, which on your computer looks pretty good. Maybe we should just watch it on YouTube, but we didn't. The cinematographer was Robert Birx, who did a dozen Hitchcock pictures and won an Oscar for To Catch a Thief in the mid-50s. Edith Head was, as always, Hitchcock's costume designer, or at least for Hedren's costumes, or costume.
She didn't have to work that hard
she
on this film.
She has two outfits, I think, in the whole movie. And then the nightgowns, with three. She has a black outfit, and then, anyway. So influence, there isn't that much, apart from the fact that I guess The Birds is a pretty famous movie in general. Even if you haven't seen it, you know the basic idea. The Simpsons, I'm sure, have parodied that. They did. The sequence where they get Maggie out of her daycare.
Yeah.
All the little kids are massing and making weird noises with their soothers.
It even includes a Hitchcock cameo walking the dog in front of the daycare.
Right. There was a Birds 2 Land's End TV movie in 1994. Hedren played Helen, whoever that is, not Melanie. So she didn't reprise her own character, but she is the only actor that was in that. And Night of the Living Dead, which came 5 years later, one of the most influential horror films ever, even more than this one, and other zombie movies for sure. Signs, which isn't a zombie movie, but it has the same kind of thing, where you're trapped in a house. Many movies have done that. The Birds only has it at the very end. But you're trapped in a house, and you can't get out, or if you try to, what's going to happen to you? Night of the Living Dead and other zombie movies is more a matter of do not go out there. With the birds, they take that chance and they get away, we think.
The birds, like zombie movies, also has the element of really strange phenomenon happening and an entire town having to react to the threat.
And no one understands. It's not like you're saying the Russians are coming, the Russians are coming. Why are the birds attacking us? Who knows? Maybe it's Melanie's fault. Maybe it's Lydia's. Maybe it's no one's. We talked about the Oscar nomination for visual effects. It didn't win that. The movie made the National Film Registry in 2016, so Congress is protecting it. Other movies that year, we've covered them all. The Lion King, The Princess Bride, Thelma Louise, and Who Framed Roger Rabbit. We covered that just a few months ago. The Birds was 7th on the top 100 thrills list. Really? 7th? It has some great thrills, but I wouldn't put it 7th.
Yeah.
Psycho was number 1. Hitch had 5 in the top 20 on that list, and 3 in the top 10. Psycho, The Birds, and North by Northwest, I think, was the third one. Which is thrilling, but I wouldn't put it in the top 10 either. I'd put it on that list somewhere. But the thrills list, even though I liked it a lot, had a lot of really dubious choices, and not enough horror films. Flat-out horror films.
Yeah.
They recognize Freddy Krueger as one of the great villains on the top 50 villains list, but Nightmare on Elm Street is not on the throws list, and it probably should be. Although Night of the Living Dead is, at least. And we talked already that the birds themselves were nominated for the top 50 villains list, but didn't make it. Hitch did have two on that list, Bates and Danvers. All right, so our second scary movie in Scary Movie Month. Our last thoughts on the birds.
The good outweighs the bad, and it's all supported by a truly unique and daring vision. It's flawed, but it's still a must-watch.
Would you recommend it to casual film fans?
Yeah, if you're a film fan, then yeah, of course.
Casual. Would you recommend any Hitchcock film to casual film fans? Although probably most people have at least heard and know about Psycho, even if they haven't actually watched it.
Look, if somebody's definition of film fan is they've seen every Marvel film, then no. If you're a classic film fan, then 100% this is on the list of movies that you must see. But since most casual film fans probably can't watch any movie that was made before 75, I would temper a recommendation based on that.
Except maybe The Godfather, which was before 75. They probably
watched
that.
Well, that's actually where I draw the line. I feel like The Godfather is the first...
That's 72.
72, okay. So before The Godfather...
With some exceptions, though. But not many. I get what you're saying.
I mean, I guess. When you talk exceptions, I'm saying that maybe they've seen It's a Wonderful Life.
One of my least favorite things, and it isn't just an age thing. We've heard people our age, even older, say this. I was born in 1972, or I was born in 1985, meaning the world didn't exist before those years. You can never possibly go back and read books, watch movies, listen to music, read stories about...
You don't like the Beatles if you were born in the 70s?
Well, that's the way some people put it. And it is more the younger generation that says that out loud, is if they're offended, you'd suggest that something existed before they came onto the planet. But a lot of people do that.
Songs can endure, and books certainly endure, but movies really don't have that same kind of staying power.
It's funny because Hitchcock was a blockbuster director of his time. And yet we're saying, casual film fans, you probably wouldn't recommend his movies the way you might recommend a Marvel film to the average person and say, you're probably going to enjoy this. It's fun. It's escapist. That's what these movies were supposed to be, generally. Psycho and The Birds are horror movies. But his other thrillers, like Rear Window and Vertigo and North by Northwest and Notorious and on and on and on, were not scary, per se. So anybody could watch them and enjoy them. And they were some of the big hits of the day.
I feel like people would be far more likely to have seen a Bond film than a Hitchcock film
probably.
From the 60s.
Those do not age well at all.
No, they don't. But maybe the campiness is part of it. But it's harder to see past when you're trying to take a film seriously. It's hard to see past the anachronisms. If somebody is not well-versed in classic film, this would not be on the list because I feel like the first half would turn them off so much.
It almost turned us off.
And there's so many better Hitchcock films.
Okay, next week we've got our third selection in Scary Movie Month, and it is The Witch. Just like It Follows, it's a modern horror movie that we've liked more each time we've seen it, or at least I have. I've seen it twice. You have not, though, right?
Just once, yeah.
When I saw it the second time on demand or whatever it was, Netflix maybe, I remember saying to you in a text or an email, we have to review this movie one day. There was so much, and that was halfway through. There's so much subtext. So the coming attraction is trivia for The Witch. Get ready for that word to come into your ears the next minute or so. Between The Witch, The Blair Witch Project, its first sequel, Blair Witch 2, the 2016 Blair Witch, Witches of Eastwick, and Halloween 3, Season of the Witch, which made the most money in actual dollars, not adjusted for inflation, actual dollars, and which made the least?
All right, so...
Stop saying gummy!
So for the answer to that question, please check out our next podcast about the Vivitch. But what if you can't wait until then? Well, you can check out our website, top100project.com. Don't forget to subscribe to the Top 100 Project on Apple Podcasts. We've covered... close to 275 movies. And that includes all 123 movies that made the AFI's 1998 and or 2007 lists of the best American films ever made. Every episode is available for free.
Chris and I have now done 10 Scoring the Movies episodes. That skews it as well.
Oh my God.
Well, unlike most podcasts, I could say, I've done 220 episodes and this is number 223. I've lost count because of all these different iterations. Continue.
So many movies to choose from, you guys. And in exchange for all of this great free content... Perhaps you could give us a rating and a review on Apple Podcasts. That would mean a lot to us. And if in a review you happen to suggest a movie that you'd like to cover that we haven't covered yet, we will take it under serious consideration. If you'd like to reach Ryan and me, we're both on Twitter. I'm at Bev Ellis Ellis, and Ryan is at MovieFiend51. Or you can reach us by email, top100projectpodcast@gmail.com. And once more, we would like to thank our sponsor, Spark Plug Coffee. Don't forget that you can enjoy a one-ton 10% discount on any coffee purchase if you use the code TOP100PROJECT at checkout.
By the way, I just said 10 Scoring the Movies episodes. Well, later the week that Birds gets posted will be the 10th. We haven't actually posted
it. You're ahead of yourself.
That is Kingpin. But I don't usually promote one podcast and the others. You know what I'm saying?
You want to get greedy?
Well, they are separate iterations, so different co-hosts for one
thing.
You're
just so prolific.
Slightly different vibe. Yeah, I'm in this edit room all the time on this computer. I never leave this room. I'm no real good out here, except I don't like the Me Too movement. It exposes people like me.
And cut.